Hi, I'm Alan Saunders, and we begin this week's Philosopher's Zone with the words of a man who was not a philosopher. The most successful ideological effects are those which have no need for words and ask no more than complicitous silence. That's the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu in 1977. Before Bourdieu died 8 years ago, he was the most quoted social scientist alive, a lauded public intellectual in France and a strong critic of neoliberalism. He was also apparently very shy. Well, we're not shy, so this week we'll try to tell you about the trained philosopher who decided that philosophy was not where it's at. Kate Huppertz is our guest today. She's a postdoctoral fellow in the Faculty of Education and Social Work at the University of Sydney. Kate, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. And let's start with what I hope is an easy question. Why do you like Pierre Bourdieu so much?
There's a few reasons why I like Pierre Bourdieu. I think probably first and foremost, he provided a cultural approach to class. So he was interested in the way that everyday cultural practices had implications for social stratification and power. So I think he provides a different approach to social class than what was offered before.
Not long ago, we did a program on the French-Algerian writer Albert Camus, but Pierre Bourdieu also has an Algerian connection. He was brought up in a rural working-class environment, and during his military service he was sent to Algiers for disciplinary reasons, apparently. Yes. He stayed on in Algiers and wrote a book called The Algerians, which came out in 1955. But it was in Algeria in the mid-1950s that this philosophy graduate experienced what one critic has described as a practical conversion from philosophy to social science. Now, why was that? What was philosophy unable to provide Bourdieu?
I think that experience radically changed Bourdieu's research trajectory, and that he thought that sociology was better able to grasp the grim realities of his experiences in a war-torn country. He thought that philosophy did ask the big questions, but sociology was better able to answer those questions through field work, through objective observation, as well as theoretical work as well.
He came, as I said, from a rural background in which his dad was a farmer turned postmaster in the village of La Serbe. State scholarship and the like got him to the major institution for French intellectuals, the École Normale Supérieure, where he topped the class. The thing about Bourdieu, though, is that this world he found himself in now, and in which he did very well, was never normal or natural to him. He observed it in a way that those born to wealth and a certain privilege couldn't or wouldn't.
I guess you could say that Bourdieu's habitus didn't fit well with the field, that he found himself in a different environment to what he was born into, and that gave him a certain amount of reflexivity. It enabled him to see class in the everyday and to see how the education system reproduces class as well.
We'll come on shortly to the concept of habitus. But he has been criticised for making too much of the poverty of his upbringing and how it influenced his thought. I think people, I've read one critic who's virtually saying to him, "Oh, come off it, Pierre, you know, you're laying it on."
Well, you know, I think it's important for sociologists to examine where they've come from as well, because they definitely affect their object of study. So I think it's important that Bourdieu was reflexive about where he's come from as well, because we can't deny the fact that our own experiences direct our influences and our life trajectories as well.
Yeah. Philip Gerrans from the University of Adelaide has written that Pierre Bourdieu developed a philosophy of social science grounded in the phenomenological tradition. This is the great European philosophical tradition, which treats knowledge as a practical ability embedded in skillful behaviour rather than an intellectual capacity. What did this amount to as an approach to social science?
Right. Well, he thought that there was, it was really important that there was practical outcome to his research. And I suppose that this is the reason why he turned from philosophy as well. He thought that research must matter for the lives of others, and he made clear links between theory and practice. And that's one of the beauties of his conceptual approach, and that he provides concepts that can be applied to social practice.
Did he think that philosophy didn't matter enough to the lives of others? Was that why he separated from it?
I think probably one reason why he distanced himself from it is because it was an elite discipline at the time. It was really revered in France. And because he felt an affinity for the underdog, I think he felt that he'd like to take on sociology as his discipline.
But though he might have turned from philosophy, his thinking was still steeped in philosophy. I mean, he built upon and used the ideas of people like Blaise Pascal, after whom he entitled his Pascalian Meditations, Ludwig Wittgenstein, whose idea of rule following was important to him, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, the phenomenologist, Edmund Husserl, also the French philosophers of science, Gaston Bachelard and Georges Canguil. Yeah. So he seems to have got a lot from philosophers, whatever he thought about philosophy as a discipline.
Yeah, he certainly did. Well, he studied philosophy, of course, at university. And, you know, he didn't research or theorise in a vacuum, and he had many very important influences. And he often wrote in reaction to dominant thought at particular points in time, like his constructive structuralism is a reaction to structuralism. So, yeah, he's definitely influenced by a number of philosophers. That's true.
We'll return later to Bourdieu's thought on exclusive institutions and schools and the like, but in terms of his legacy, one of the ideas that we owe to him is that of cultural capital. Now, this is an idea which has seeped into the public imagination. It expresses both his social radicalism and his commitment to a self-critical, scientific, empirically based world of research and public engagement. So what is cultural capital exactly? Where do we find it?
Okay. Well, Bourdieu referred to several types of capital: economic, educational, social, and cultural capital. And cultural capital is all learned cultural competencies and knowledges. So when you learn a new language or you learn an instrument, you're investing in cultural capital. But cultural competencies can be other things as well, like your style of dress, the way that you decorate your home, that sort of thing. So cultural capital is something that people with economic capital probably have, but don't necessarily have. It can be quite separate from economic capital. And so when you talk about people with new and old money, you sometimes see this division. You see people with old money might have cultural capital, and then they have a certain taste, certain consumption practices, which people with new money don't necessarily have, because they don't have that history, that socialisation.
So, well, it's interesting that you mention old money, because of course if you've got new money, you can have just as much money as anybody who's got old money, but you will have different social capital. So really this is about a type of power that is not about who owns the means of production or whether you sell your labour.
Yeah, it's quite separate from that, although they're related. And that's why Bourdieu is so unique, in that he looks at class and sees class as evident in places other than the economic. It's not just the job that you do and how you earn your money. It's also your consumption practices, what you like and what you dislike, and your relationships with others.
Kate, while we're on the subject of social capital, let's turn to aesthetics. Bourdieu wrote a rather influential work on taste and why we think some things are tasteful. You mentioned the way you decorate your house being part of your social capital. Yeah. Why we think some things are tasteful and others are not. In fact, distinction, a social critique of the judgment of taste, was named as one of the 20th century's 10 most important works of sociology by the International Sociological Association. And after Bourdieu's death, Stuart Jeffries said in the Guardian newspaper that he applied the notion of habitus to taste and attempted to undermine Kantian aesthetics, which claim that our notion of what is beautiful is not determined by social influences. By contrast, Bourdieu argued that preferences for luxury cars, designer clothing, expensive goods and works of art are shaped by people's habitus. Well, you've already used the word. Let's get to this concept of habitus, which is clearly central to understanding Bourdieu.
Yeah, it definitely is. It is central to his understanding of the social world. Habitus is simply a word that Bourdieu used to describe the ways in which we internalise social structures and norms. So habitus is a word that he uses to describe the way that we internalise our histories, and that directs our practices, our social practices, our ways of being and understanding in the world. And each of us have our own individual habitus, our own unique habitus, because we all have unique histories. But obviously, we share those histories with others. So there is a collective habitus as well that we share with our class group. And that directs our likes and our dislikes, so that particular class groups have particular tastes that are coordinated without explicit coordination. It operates through our bodies and upon our bodies without explicit coordination.
He talked, and I mean, in a way, from the way the discussion's gone already, you can tell this is coming. He talked a lot about symbolic power, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And that's another unique part of Bourdieu's approach. He saw power as both material and symbolic. And he saw the world as operating under a doxic order. He thought there was a classificatory system that operated that impacted our mental schemas. And this classificatory system was in the hands of those who dominate society. And we, the dominated, are complicit in our domination, in that we accept those schemes, those classifications, as natural and inevitable.
You're listening to The Philosopher's Zone on ABC Radio National with me, Alan Saunders. And today, our guest, Kate Huppertz from the University of Sydney, is discussing the late Pierre Bourdieu, the great French sociologist. One of Bourdieu's major contributions is the research and thinking he did about how power and knowledge are circulated in subtle and subconscious ways, whether in the classroom or at the dinner table in a middle-class family or in an institution for the elite. And here is Pierre Bourdieu being interviewed in the documentary Sociology is a Martial Art, details of which you can find on our website.
Bon, par exemple, un très beau travail qui a été fait par une sociologue américaine qui a montré que les enfants.
There is a beautiful study done by an American sociologist which showed that middle class children, children from the bourgeoisie, know how to give the teacher just what she wants because they come from the same background.
Mon chéri, mon mignon, mon poussin, etc.
The teachers, just like mummy, the teacher calls them my darling or honey, and they're happy. They know how to react, so they are well perceived, they get good marks, and they are happy. So you have certain factors that depend on prior knowledge, not school knowledge, but just as important, how to behave, not to throw your school bag on the floor, how to keep your notebooks tidy, etc. The words of Pierre Bourdieu from the documentary Sociology is a Martial Art. And here's Kate Huppertz on Bourdieu and power.
His notion of power is very similar to Foucault's, in that he saw power as gentle, as something that is productive, that's even pleasurable, that operates beneath direct institutional discrimination. It's channeled through our relationships with others, through our thoughts and feelings. It's not something that is coercive. He didn't think there was someone standing over us with a big stick, that it's something that happens through cognition and misrecognition and feeling.
I wonder how much this is a new idea, how much it's new to Bourdieu. I mean, there's a song in My Fair Lady where Professor Higgins sings, "The moment an Englishman speaks, he makes another Englishman despise him." So there's clearly a sense here of social capital embodied in language.
Mm-hmm.
Did people must have known before Bourdieu that they were making these sort of judgments based on these sorts of distinctions?
Yeah, I think that it's common sense, and if we're reflexive and reflect on our own social situations, yeah, I think we might be aware that these things are happening. But Bourdieu articulated it, and he provided us with really useful concepts in which to study these practices, and in that way I think he's really unique.
He attempted to expose unwritten rules and practices in education and more broadly in the worlds frequented by intellectuals and the cultural elite. He did this in the books Homo Academicus from 1984 and The State Nobility, great title, 1989. Tell us what these works gave us.
Well, these works, as in distinction, looked at the connection between culture and social stratification and power. And he really challenged the idea that education systems are meritocratic, and he saw them as involved in the reproduction of class and inequality. He saw universities in particular as channeling or distributing cultural capital, and of course it's the wealthy who have primary access to universities, so universities are complicit in this process of producing and reproducing privilege. In those books he also discussed how the cultural is a key site for struggle, and the fact that nobility is alive and well in France.
We mentioned that he turned from philosophy but was still shaped by it and had been very good at it when he was a student. In his work on cultural and educational power and distinctions of taste, can we see the influence of specific philosophers, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, in Pascalian meditations, of course, that makes reference to Pascal, because Pascal was interested in a symbolic power as well, and the plight of everyday people, and uncovering why the seemingly nonsensical practices, how they might have a rationality to them. So that was definitely an influence. You can see a number of influences in Bourdieu's work.
He saw domination as more often than not gentle and hidden, and he spent much of his life exposing the complex interplay going on in schools and even in how we determine whether something is tasteful or not. He said himself he was using social science to denaturalize and defatalize the social world. I guess he must have thought that the social sciences, underpinned by philosophical thinking, were more capable of this, of doing this denaturalizing and defatalizing, than philosophy was on its own.
Yeah, that's a project that Bourdieu took on later on in his career. I think he took a more political turn in his career, and he saw the task of sociology to denaturalize things that are considered natural in social life. He thought that sociology could uncover a rational utopia, and he engaged more and more in political life. I think because he could make that link between practice through his empirical investigation, he thought perhaps that philosophy might be less appropriate for understanding everyday issues and relating big theoretical ideas back to everyday people.
He said, "That's the trouble with sociologists. I always seem to be sad, pessimistic, and deterministic." But was he really all that deterministic?
He certainly has been criticised for being structurally deterministic. I think that his concept of habitus, it actually mediates between structures, but some people suggest that he overemphasizes the structuring aspects of the habitus, and that certainly is an important critique of Bourdieu. But he also talks about innovation as well as reproduction. And so you have to look at those two different aspects of Bourdieu's theorization.
You use the phrase structurally deterministic. What does that mean? What are the structures that are doing the determining?
Social structures and norms, common ways of knowing and being in the world. So, for instance, if you're thinking about gender, there's a gender order in which men are considered as superior to women, or men are cultured and women are closer to nature. So that those types of classifications structure our action.
But if he thought that there could be such a thing as a social utopia, presumably he must have thought that structures could be transcended.
Yes, I think that he did. I mean, he's an example in himself, in that he started off from a working class background and rose to the apex of French intellectual society. And he thought wherever there was domination, there was actually resistance. So he did think that there was the possibility for resistance and change, and for people to transcend their cultural background and class background. Yes.
Before he died in 2002, Pierre Bourdieu had become a bona fide celebrity in France, in the way that you people like him can in France. There's a scene in a documentary called Sociology is a Martial Art, where a young female fan of his stops him on the streets and basically delivers a monologue, rather sweetly but intensely, without letting him get a word in, about how important he has been to her life and to her thinking. But Bourdieu himself was, as we've said, rather shy. So how did he handle this sort of public prominence, and how did he let it happen?
Yeah, it was an unexpected outcome for Bourdieu, in that he was shy and he often refused to appear on television and kept his private life very much to himself. I think particularly after Foucault died, he was France's prominent intellectual, and intellectuals tend to be revered in France, so that's the situation that he found himself in. The work that he wrote on the education system is said to have had quite an impact on students in the 60s and inspired some of the protests of 1968. So he's had an influence on political groups and communities. And towards the end, he did become more of a public intellectual, in that he engaged in a lot of political debates. So I think that's a progression that he did end up wholly participating in, but I don't think he liked the public attention. Yeah.
Well, you talk about his influence. Do you think that influence will continue? Will he be remembered, or were his ideas mostly useful for the time in which he lived?
Oh, no, I think that he'll continue to be influential. I think his influence is actually growing, and that there's come about a lot of new interesting research on the manifestation, cultural manifestations of class. And feminists in particular are starting to engage in his work in really interesting and unique ways. So I don't think that his influence is over, not at all.
Well, Kate Papatz, thank you very much indeed for being with us.
Thank you.
Kate is postdoctoral fellow in the Faculty of Education and Social Work at the University of Sydney. And if you want to share with us your thoughts on Pierre Bourdieu, or maybe your thoughts on what your education did to you for good or ill, just go to our website at abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. Click on this week's programme and go to add your comment. The show is produced by Kyla Slavin, with technical production by Charlie McCune, and I'm Alan Saunders. Back next week.
You love the seven deadly sins on the Spirit of Things, but do virtues make you squirm? Take prudence. Well, actually, some people can't.
It still seems to me to be a kind of such a negative
thing, you know, it makes me laugh.
Join me, Rachel Kahn, in the first of our series on the seven vital virtues. It's all about prudence with Elizabeth Farrelly, James Franklin, and a man who takes the prudent lessons of history very seriously, Bob Carr.
Now, Rachel, I just thought of the one clinching example of prudence in international relations. How lucky the world was to have had a prudent John F. Kennedy and a prudent Nikita Khrushchev in the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, when we know there were people on the American side, at least, who were urging an exchange. And Kennedy and Khrushchev took a step back, prudently.
Join me, Rachel Kahn, in a lively discussion on the unfashionable virtue of prudence. You can search for virtues on the ABC Radio National website.